PRN.FM, your station for progressive viewpoints on politics, economics, health, the environment, and a whole lot more. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us. Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting live, but out on the road filming. I have a lot of filming to do, about another 80 individuals for the films coming up. And when they're finished and ready to go, I'll certainly inform this audience worldwide so you can watch them. They are original, nothing like I've done before, on all important social issues. Today we're going to deal with social issues. We're going to deal with The Pornography of Hatred by William John Cox from Counterpunch. We're going to deal with Does Fear Lead to Fascism? A Culture of Fear and the Epigenetics of Terror, John Whitehead from Op-Ed News. We're also going to look at environmental issues, including Tibetan threat to water vital, Alex Kirby, Climate News Network, and Extinction is Forever, Robert J. Burroughs from Countercurrents. Additionally, we're going to take on some other issues that I feel are important that don't get the attention they need. And among those issues will be looking at, we're going to look at the censorship of speech regarding vaccines and autism with Professor Mary Holland. And Professor Holland is well known to people in the freedom of speech movement. And she's the director of the graduate level legal program at New York University School of Law. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. Always first with health and healing. A good article from Indiana University, published in the British Journal of Cancer, shows that researchers found magnesium, that's your macro mineral, intake may be beneficial in preventing pancreatic cancer. And this study, magnesium, quote, intake and incidence of pancreatic cancer, the vitamins and lifestyle study, it is very positive. Why? Pancreatic cancer is the fourth leading cause of cancer-related death in both men and women in the United States. The overall occurrence of pancreatic cancer has not significantly changed in almost 15 years, but their mortality rate has gotten much worse, meaning more people are dying. Quote, pancreatic cancer is really unique and different from other cancers. The 5-year survival rate is really low, so that makes prevention and identifying risk factors or predictors associated with pancreatic cancer very important. And then it goes on to talk about how in this particular study they looked at everything within a person's lifestyle, and lo and behold, there was magnesium. They analyzed the data from 66,000 men and women, 50 to 76, looking at direct associations between magnesium and pancreatic cancer, and whether age, gender, body mass, meaning your fat content, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs used played a role. And what they found was, quote, for those at a higher risk of pancreatic cancer, adding a magnesium supplement to their diet may prove beneficial in preventing this disease. How about that? That is really terrific. So I would suggest about 800 to 1,200 milligrams of magnesium a day, and that can make a big difference. Additionally, a study from the University of Cambridge says that epigenetic discoveries suggest DNA modification more diverse than previously thought. Let me quote this. It says, the world of epigenetics, where molecule switches attached to DNA turn genes on and off, has just gotten bigger with the discovery by a team of scientists from the University of Cambridge of a new type of epigenetic modification. Published today in the journal Nature Structural and Molecular Biology, the discovery suggests that many more DNA modifications than previously thought may exist in humans. DNA, this audience certainly understands, I've done many shows on this, it's made up of four bases, molecules known as adenine, cytosine, guanine, and thymine, and the A, C, G, and T letters. Now, strings of these letters form genes which provide the code for essential proteins and other regions of DNA. And epigenetics, by the way, that the Greek prefix means on top of, is the study of how genes are switched on or off. It's thought to be one explanation for how our environment and behavior, such as our diet, impacts us. And this was an extraordinarily important study on the subject. So let me put this into lay language, and I'll give you an actual example. Let's say that you're a person that has had to suffer with some different problems, either physical or emotional or both, and you don't know why. It's not that you eat a bad diet. It's not that you have not been around some nice people or had some good people in relationships, but it all seems to collapse at some point. And then you're left alone, and hence lonely, and hence depressed. And then once you get into a depressive cycle, you start questioning, am I a lovable person? What have I done wrong? Or the other way is, why is everyone against me, always blaming someone else? You either take all the blame yourself or you blame others. It can go in either direction. We have always thought that this was merely circumstance. Well, you're out of a job right now. Well, your cat died. Well, your kids have left home. You got the empty nest syndrome. Well, you caught your husband cheating, and you have every reason to be anxious and depressed or insecure because you trusted a relationship that betrayed you. And indeed, all of those are completely legitimate reasons for going through a period of time where we don't feel good about things, because everything we thought we should feel good about changed. And generally not in a good way. But we have also seen that no matter how much therapy, counseling, encouragement by friends, it doesn't always change. And hence, we go through life with a constant set of repeating patterns. Hence, the idea is to look at patterns of behavior, not one-offs. All of us have gone through situations in life where we just have something go wrong, we can't control the outcome, and we're going to feel unhappy about it or sad about it or angry about it until we reconnect with something to take its place. And generally that's how it works. When we have something that honors us, honors life, where we can feel joy and love and happiness, creativity and excitement by, then what was bothering us in the past becomes less significant or non-significant at all, and we go forward. Until Bruce Lipton, the father of epigenetics in the 1980s, discovered while working as a molecular biologist at Stanford University that when he took the DNA, when he took the gene out of the cell, it still functioned for a period of time doing what it was supposed to. And he's thinking, how in the world does this happen? It's like taking the brain out of a person's skull, and yet the person still continues to think and talk. Taking the engine out of a car, and the car still drives. How is this even possible? In comes epigenetics. Epi, above, meaning the entirety of the environment you're in. Now, here's what we now know. It can go back several generations. So let's say that you're born and you're given attention. What you see going on in your life, how your parents and siblings or friends relate with each other, you will absorb that, and that becomes part of your epigenetics. So before there's an intellect to differentiate what is right and wrong, what is reasonable and unreasonable, what I should keep and leave, we're absorbing everything 100%. So let's say that your parents are okay, but their parents weren't. They were fighting, they were judgmental, they were strict, they were disciplinarians to the extreme. You had to do something exceptional to get them to say that job well done. So you weren't living your own life in their parents' generation, or your grandparents, you had to constantly please them. And then they might give you some acknowledgement. And it was also cultural. Different cultures are more relaxed and less judgmental, and others, like the Germanic cultures, extremely judgmental. And the English as well. And very, very class-oriented. So a lot of how you feel about yourself is which class you're in. Do you have a good sense of self? Do you have some excessive sense of importance based upon your title, the privilege of where you were born? That affects your epigenetics. And that frequently makes you less sensitive to other people. In fact, almost disdainful of other people. The idea is, what, you're not rich too? Well, you're lazy. Why would you say that? First of all, not everybody wants to be rich. Secondly, not everyone can be rich. Circumstance is not going to weigh in their favor. And thirdly, what right do you have to come from this position to make judgments on people? You don't know them. You haven't been in their life. You haven't been in their shoes. And yet that's epigenetics. So now we're told you're born with certain characteristics beyond your personality that will determine how you function in life, how you function in relationships, how you function in your own personal life, how you take care of yourself or abuse yourself. So it's not just what happened. Were you breastfed? Or were you loved by your mother? Or did your father scold you? It goes beyond that. That's epigenetics. And now they're finding it's even more pervasive. It can be multi-generational. Well, how in the world are you supposed to know what went on a couple generations ago and how people treated one another, what they thought about life? Because you're picking up their energy. It's encoded in your DNA. Now, here's the key. What causes it to turn on? Or what causes it to turn off? That's the circumstance you're in, and whether you're mindful, because there is a way of stopping the negative impact of our conditioning and epigenetic conditioning by staying mindful, conscious, and keep remembering you're a spiritual being living in a physical body. You are a happy person frequently around unhappy people. You're a positive person around negative people. You're an honest person around unethical people. And you're committed to a higher ideal around people who bottom feed everything. So do you succumb to that epigenetic environment and become a part of them? Or do you transcend the environment you're in? I may be poor, but I'm not. I have everything I need to be happy. I may not be in the best environment with the best people, but that does not mean I'm going to lower my standards and how I feel about myself or others to be accepted by these individuals. And if you really want to see how epigenetics works, look at how many soldiers go off to war who would never in their daily lives thought about hurting an innocent person. But in the epigenetic conditioning of war, you're not just alone. You're part of a whole family. And that whole family has a certain mindset. And there's very strict hierarchical rules. You're not allowed to make judgment calls, even though the Nuremberg trial brought the Nuremberg laws that said, you can never again commit any crime because you said that you were told to by a superior. If you feel or have reasonable belief that what you're doing or others are doing is a crime against humanity, then you have every right to violate their commandments, their rules, their laws. So when was the last time of the millions of people serving, they broke the rules? Can you name me? How many? Recently, four airmen who were drone killers came forward, and now they're being harassed. Abu Ghraib, that didn't go up high. All of these indiscretions, that's also part of your epigenetics, where you turn off the gene that says, be courageous. You turn on the gene that says, I will be a victim. I will be vulnerable. I can't say what I think. If I do, I won't be here any longer. Now look at all the indiscretions, the criminalities. Look at the things that happen that you become aware of, if you have, and you chose not to speak up, or you chose to speak up. Both of those are directly related to epigenetics. So more on epigenetics on upcoming programs, because it's an extraordinarily important area. From a study on supporting our microcirculation. That's the circulation to your brain, which most people don't have a good circulation to the brain because they have some blockages in the carotid artery, and also to the feet, the extremities, legs and calves. That's why you get those little spider veins and purple veins and fungus toenails, because you don't have good healthy circulation. Well, according to this new research, they looked at 90,000 adults without cancer or history of cardiovascular disease who were followed for 11 years, and then they took a look at what was happening in their life, and they found that mango made a big difference. So mangoes, turns out, have a whole lot of good in them. Most people just think that they taste good, but there's more to that than tasting good. There's just a lot of good. Quote, measurement of microcirculation provides information on metabolism, vascular reality. The study suggests moderate benefits, effects of improving microcirculation, partly mediated by the endothelial nitric oxide synthesis activity, meaning the nutrients in mangoes can help with the microcirculation. So that's important. So, and this was published in Nutrition and Metabolic Insights. So if you would like better microcirculation, just have some mango. Also, the University of Barcelona in Spain, high doses of the omega-3 fatty acids and protein shows muscle wasting benefits, quote from the study. Omega-3 protein and vitamin juice formulated by Norwegian Biotechs became the first nutrient product to demonstrate a positive effect on the disease-related wasting syndrome, cachexia. Quote, cachexia is a wasting syndrome characterized by several mechanisms, for instance, inflammation, weight loss, and we know from previous studies and experiments that our drinks, that what we consume, can affect this. And why is this important? What do we need to take away from this? Simple. If you've ever worked with people with cancer, especially end-stage cancer, you find they all suffer from cachexia. They're just wasting away. They're skeletal. But if you go to Africa and you look at the kids suffering from malnutrition, they got little tiny spindly arms and legs, but this little bulbous belly, and that's filled with parasites and distended. They're dying, and about 27,000 die every 24 hours. And also people who frequently suffer from parasites end up with cachexia. The parasites are eating all the nutrition and they start to waste away. So by taking the omega-3 fatty acids, I suggest twice a day, 2,000 units or 2,000 milligrams. And protein, I suggest a plant-based protein, 20 to 30 grams, and a mixture of antioxidants and vitamin A. You can do two things. Help the person stop losing weight and actually regain muscle. And B, you can help prevent thousands upon thousands of children from dying in Africa. Now, if they added vitamin D and vitamin C to that, that would even be more beneficial. But this study actually showed that it helps with cachexia. And in America, you have cachexia. In hospitals, there's nothing they can do for you. Their success rate has just failed. I wrote an article when I was doing my Politics Cancer series on a doctor from University of Syracuse who had a invention that helped block cachexia. And it was legitimate, and he was good at it, but no one paid attention to it because you couldn't patent it. Finally, light therapy is more effective than Prozac in major depression, from Dr. Michael Murray. Quote, feeling sad? New data shows that light therapy is more effective than Prozac on patients with significant depression. Bright light therapy has a proven track record of success in the treatment of seasonal affective disorder, commonly referred to as winter blues. A new study from the University of British Columbia shows that Simple and safe therapy is effective for non-seasonal major depression. In fact, researchers showed light therapy was much more effective than fluoxetine or Prozac. During the winter months, sufferers of SAD typically feel depressed. They generally slow down, oversleep, overeat, crave carbohydrates. In the summer, these same people feel elated, active, and energetic. Although many variables may be responsible for SAD, the lack of exposure to full-spectrum natural light appears to be the most logical explanation. The antidepressive effect of full-spectrum light therapy has been demonstrated in well-monitored controlled studies. And then it goes on to talk about the newest data from these major depression patients who are given 30 minutes a day or a placebo, meaning they got full-spectrum light or they got a light but it was not full-spectrum, or they were given fluoxetine 20 milligrams a day, that's Prozac, or a placebo. And the group that got the full-spectrum light did remarkably well. The group that got the placebo or Prozac, no. So that's the latest on that. One more reason to get out, get some sun. And that's why people living in southern states or sun states have far less depression than those living in northern altitudes. I'm Gary Null. We're going to take a brief break. Come right back. Please stay with us.
Walking through the park, it wasn't quite dark. There was a man sitting on a bench. Out of the crowd, as his head lowly bowed, he just moaned and it made no sense. He just go,
I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting on the issues that make a difference in our lives. There's a danger in pandering of hatred that goes beyond the freedom of expression. We've all experienced it, at least those of you who are ethicists, those of you who are activists, those of you who care deeply about something. You understand that when you commit yourself to any truth, you're also committing yourself to the challenge of that which is not truthful, which will push back against you. They will engage in lies, deception, a character assassination, and more often than not, they will succeed unless people know you and know who you are. I believe that we have to understand this, not only as individuals, but also understand the implications for a whole society, for the racist elements that occur, the biases. And I believe that William John Cox has done an outstanding job in explaining this. He believes that there's a right to profit from supplying the seeds of destruction to those who have the need to blame others for the poverty of their existence. Now think of that for a moment. Bar owners who continue to serve drunks could be held responsible for the deaths of those later killed in traffic collisions, right? But to what extent should those who peddled their rhetoric of hatred and bigotry and violence be held responsible for the consequences of their merchandising? These were some of the questions that confronted us in 1980 when William John Cox represented a survivor of Auschwitz against those who denied the Holocaust. Alleging an injurious denial of an established fact, William John Cox argued that someone should not be able to grasp a blatant lie in one hand and slap another person in the face with it. The matter was resolved when a Los Angeles Superior Court ruled, quote, "This court does not take judicial notice of the fact that Jews were gassed to death at Auschwitz concentration camp in Poland during the summer of 1944. It is simply a fact," end quote. The defendants were the Institute of Historical Review and its parent company, the Liberty Lobberty. which was a conglomerate of radical right-wing organizations that marketed individualized packages of hatred to those with particular proclivities. They attempted to move onto college campuses by circulating a slick, scholarly, supposed journal that offered pseudoscientific theories denying the existence of the Nazi genocide of European Jewry. We were successful at blunting its collegiate campaign. However, 35 years later, these and similar organizations, now making full use of the Internet, continue to promulgate lies for profit. The danger of these lies threatens everyone, not just those targeted by propaganda of violent hatred. James Madison, the author of the Bill of Rights, considered the First Amendment to be the most important, since without the freedom of speech, all others are forfeit. The ink was hardly dry on the Darkhmit before Congress enacted the Sedition Act in 1798 to punish scandalous, malicious writings about the president or the government which caused them to be held in contempt or disrepute. The act expired with the election of Thomas Jefferson in 1800, and President Adams later considered the act to be the greatest mistake of this administration. Opposition by Jefferson and others who encouraged nullification of the act planted the seeds of disunion that later led to the Civil War. The Supreme Court never had a chance to review the Sedition Act, but it later held that the First Amendment protected all speech except the lewd and obscene, the profane and libelous, and insulting or fighting words, those which, by their very utterance, inflict injury or intend to incite an immediate breach of peace. In a Ku Klux Klan case, 1969, the court allowed racist and hate-filled speech unless it was directed to inciting an imminent lawless action and is likely to incite or produce such action. More recently, in 1992, the court struck down an ordinance that criminalized racist and hate-filled nonverbal speech, such as cross burnings, as contravening the First Amendment. The court focused on the mode of expression rather than the content. Hate speech is protected unless it leads to imminent violence. All this legal activity concerned itself with the criminalization of speech, both verbal and nonverbal. However, civil litigation against hate speech brought by those who are offended or affected by the speech has a different legal history. Henry Ford, the automobile magnate, was a notorious anti-Semite who directed his newspaper to attack an agricultural cooperative movement as defrauding American farmers on behalf of an international Jewish conspiracy. He was personally sued for libel by the movement's leader, and 2 years of litigation ensued during which it became apparent that Ford would be unable to prove the truth of his allegation. To avoid having to testify in trial, Ford issued a generalized apology to the entire Jewish people that had been secretly prepared by the head of the American Jewish Committee. Ford was able to escape civil liability and, undeterred, went on to publish his collection of articles in an anti-Semitic pamphlet, The International Jew, which is still available on the Internet. He also funded the printing and distribution of 500,000 copies of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, a fraudulent incitement to racial and religious hatred. The Civil Rights Act of 1964 imposed civil liability on employees for tolerating hate speech by their employees if it created a hostile or offensive work environment. As a result, many universities adopted speech codes regulating the speech of students and faculty. In an attempt to avoid a hostile educational environment, university speech codes can also create a lack of tolerance for a diversity of opinion. Speech codes can cause non-conforming students to self-censor educationally viable participation in discussions. It is a delicate balance, and some of the codes have been struck down as being an unwarranted infringement of First Amendment rights. Among the first exceptions to free speech was the lewd and obscene, usually referred to as pornography, originally prohibited altogether. The portrayal of a sexual subject for the purpose of sexual arousal is no longer a crime, as long as it does not depict children and minors are not exposed to it. There are parallels between pornography and hate speech in that, while offensive to many, if not most, people, they are allowable in order to preserve the greater good of free expression. In both cases, potentially harmful material is distributed for profit in order to satisfy the prurient and unhealthy interest of the consumer. Free speech, even that which is repugnant to most people, is so important that the American Civil Liberties Union has defended the right of the Ku Klux Klan to distribute racist literature promulgated to preserve the purity of white blood. Among the most alarming hate speech is the growing popularity of the white power, racist, and anti-Semitic music, primarily presented in the genres of rock and country. The music employs explicit lyrics to appeal to the unique prejudices of its listeners. And while country hate music is primarily directed against the federal government and blacks, white power music targets Jews, homosexuals, immigrants, and anyone not considered to be white. National Socialism's heavy metal music promotes white supremacy and racial separation and anti-Semitism and Nazi paganism. In the vernacular of hatred, non-whites are mud people, and Jews are the devil's spawn. And then you have internet hate speech. With the advent of the internet and social media, hate groups have extended the range and ferocity of their attacks. The radical right-wing organizations we confronted in the 1980s now have colorful and dynamic web pages to attract visitors and new members. The Institute for Historical Review maintains a website and page on Facebook where it is liked by 674 friends. Willis Carto, who founded the Liberty Lobby and the site and later lost control to staff members during a palace coup, has rebounded with the Barnes Review, which peddles hate literature on the internet in competition with his former organizations. In addition, he launched the American Free Press, which promotes anti-Semitic conspiracy theories and publishes online articles by Pat Buchanan and other conservative writers. Internet websites and social media were in the news following the three most recent mass shootings. On social media, Chris Harper Mercer, a college student, described himself as a conservative Republican with a disdain of organized religion. He expressed an admiration of the on-air murderer of two television employees in Virginia, and he posted a photograph of himself with a rifle on Facebook. Regarding the Virginia shooter, Harper Mercer wrote, quote, "Seems the more people you kill, the more you're in the limelight." His Gmail address was Iron Cross, a seeming reference to Nazi Germany, and he was found to have shared Nazi videos on the internet. Harper Mercer, clad in body armor, carried six guns onto a college campus in southern Oregon on October 1st, where he confronted students, faculty, and classrooms, forcing students to state their religion. He killed those who he responded Christians, saying, "You're going to see God in just about 1 second." Eight students and their professors were murdered, nine wounded, before Harper Mercer committed suicide. Hoping to start a race war, Dylan Roof massacred nine African Americans as they attended service in a historical black church in South Carolina in June of 2015. The 21-year-old had created a website, The Last Rhodesian, on which he promoted racial apartheid. He researched his views on the website of the Council on Conservative Citizens, formerly known as the White Citizens Council, the nation's largest white nationalist group. He also posted comments on neo-Nazi website, Daily Stormer. Roof was indoctrinated to believe that those blacks were stupid and violent. That's what he wrote. And, quote, "Someone has to have the bravery to take it to the real world." Roof demonstrated his bravery, cowardly, by firing and repeatedly reloading his semiotic handgun into his helpless victims as they were praying. Another racist predator, John Russell Hauser, randomly sprayed patrons with bullets in a Louisiana movie theater in July 2015, murdering two people and wounding nine, before killing himself. Hauser had adopted the Nazi flag as a symbol of his resistance to the government, and he supported KKK Grand Wizard David Duke. Writing on a neo-Nazi political website, Hauser emphasized the power of the lone wolf. On other websites, he expressed anti-Semitic thought and supported white power. He wrote that, quote, "Hitler is loved for the results of his pragmatism," and discussed the, quote, "role of blacks in building and maintaining this alliance of evil that literally grips the globe." On another, he commented, quote, "It's a shame. Tim McVeigh, the Oklahoma City Bomber, is not going to be with us to enjoy the hilarity turning the tables on the Iron Hand," end quote. Right-wing lone wolf terrorist attacks by single individuals are now the greatest terrorist threat to the people of the United States. The Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitors Nazis and white supremacist websites such as Stormfront, has documented that more than 100 people have been killed by individuals actively involved with Stormfront in the past 5 years. A recent wave of arsons at black churches has the FBI investigating them as hate crimes. And President Obama has stated that right-wing extremists pose the greatest danger to the United States. West Point's Combating Terrorism Center documents that since 9/11, 50 people have been killed in the United States by Islamic extremists. 254 people have been murdered by right-wing or sovereign citizen extremists. 500% more. Mostly disrupted, there have been only 6 terrorism-related plots by Islamic extremists in the United States since 9/11. While there have been an average of 337 planned attacks each year by right-wing extremists, that's 5,600% more. So, in conclusion, in an environment of unrestrained speech, there's a danger that politically hostile hate language will not be sufficiently moderated by voices of reason and caution, and that political dialogue will be moved in a direction that is harmful to freedom. It is not difficult to reflect upon the circumstances in Germany that gave rise to the Nazi movement and the dictatorship of Adolf Hitler. It is easy to make comparisons to the gaggle of Republican candidates, each seeking to outdo the other in proclaiming that he or she is strong enough to confront the immigration problem and to reassert the military might of the United States to deflect Islamic terrorists. Looking more closely at just one of the candidates, the current leader in the presidential primary race, Donald Trump, is the epitome of what could go wrong with politically promoting the strong man to deal with America's problems. A website, Women for Trump, gushes, quote, "Trump reminds us something we haven't seen in a long time, strong alpha males in politics. Many have forgotten what a man is," end quote. Trump inherited a real estate empire created by his father, Frederick Christ Trump, who was arrested at a KKK rally in 1927. In 1979, Fred Trump was sued for refusing to rent to African Americans and for forcing blacks to vacate his premises. The civil rights case was settled with a consent decree. However, the Justice Department later reported that Trump agents continued to create, quote, "a substantial impediment to the full employment of equal opportunity." Trump Jr. has described Mexican immigrants as rapists and murderers and has called for the creation of a great wall on the southern border to keep out illegal immigrants. The United States has already built more than 700 miles of walls and deploys a comprehensive and expensive system of cameras, sensors, drones along the southern border. Corporate America, which presently operates private prisons for corralling illegal immigrants, is lobbying to increase the privatization of border security. Can fascism, complete corporate control of the government, be far distant under the administration of a President Trump? The Daily Stormer, a neo-Nazi news website criticized by other white supremacists as overly promoting Nazism, endorsed Trump for president, saying, quote, "He is willing to say what Americans think." One would imagine that with his vanity, comb-over, red face, twisted mouth, outlandish statements, Trump would be an irrelevant and marginally entertaining spectacle in the campaign. Whether his status as a front-runner is because of or in spite of his bigoted statements about people of color and misogynist references to women, Republican candidates are being pushed towards the extreme right, along with the entire electoral dialogue. And one final thought. It was just this year that there was a major movement by the pro-corporate vaccine pharmaceutical cartels to get mandatory vaccination into every single kid's body in America, doing it state by state, cooperating with ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, that has enormous control, if not total control, over the vast amount of laws in the last 35 years. They passed over 22,000. You never heard of one of them. The media never once let us know by any original investigative journalism that this group even existed. Some 200 to 300 of the leading corporate interests were getting laws at the state level that served their interest, and in effect giving the people who did not represent you but claim they did, your state legislators, giving them the bills that then they would go back and pass as laws. As a result, California was the lightning rod for their effort. By having individuals who had received money directly from the vaccine maker, and I exposed that on a broadcast, showing I named the politician, they were mostly Democrats, and how much they received from just one of those, plus the leader of that, who received over $500,000, I showed that how can you pass something that's mandatory when you have no science to back it up? So we completed a major documentary called The Silent Epidemic, and we gave it free to everyone who was heading any group in California and said, get this to your membership, put this on local television. And we gave a panel of 25 board-certified physicians and scientists, all of whom had looked at thousands upon thousands of hours each. Two of them had over 12,000 hours alone. So they were more knowledgeable than any human being on the planet. More knowledgeable, more scholarly. And mind you, they were originally pro-vaccine. They were now anti-vaccine, but not based upon any political or ideological reference, purely scientific. The evidence was not there to guarantee that the vaccines we were mandating our children must take had been tested for safety and efficacy. To the contrary, another group of scientists, including toxicologists who were professors, were interviewed, selected to be there as spokespersons. And the trouble is the people wanting freedom of choice, even if they were pro-vaccine, maybe spreading their vaccines out instead of having their kid get them all at once, because that's when mainly autism and other diseases occur, and injury occurs when you give them all at once and overwhelms the tiny toddler's or baby's immune system. These were not anti-vaccine people. They were pro-vaccine, but they wanted a different schedule vaccine. And why give any kid in America hepatitis B? It's completely fraudulent. Unless the mother has hepatitis, and you know that when she's pregnant, there's no reason for it. And the kid doesn't even have the ability to build antibodies from the vaccine, and science shows that. So the entire scientific model had been perverted, debased for the needs of the individuals who were the pro-vaccine advocates, all of whom had financial ties. And the leading spokesperson out there had received tens of millions of dollars. And that was unfortunate, but that was the reality. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Let's go over and say hello to Professor Mary Holland, Director of the Graduate Legal Skills Program at New York University School of Law, specializing in international human rights, public law, and vaccine law safety and injury compensation. She has a son who regressed into autism following the MMR vaccine, and she has degrees from Harvard and other institutions, and also a JD from Columbia University, where she has also taught international law in its law school. She is the co-author of Vaccine Epidemic: How Corporate Greed, Biased Science, and Coercive Government Threatens Our Human Rights, Health Freedom, and Our Children. Her website is vaccineepidemic.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you.
Recently, you wrote a response to two professors in medical law who wished to censor speech that supports a vaccine autism connection. One author is James Hodge at Arizona State University, someone who obviously has a conflict of interest given that he has received funding in the past from the CDC to compose a legal basis for school vaccination programs. He also received many federal grants to advise on projects for the Department of Health and Human Services. And the second author, Professor Doug Campos, Outcult, at the University of Arizona, who happens to be a member of the CDC's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. Therefore, we know clearly who these two authors are serving as a mouthpiece for, and it's not true evidence-based medicine. So based upon their recommendations that politicians should be censored from speaking on a possible autism vaccine link, and their suggestion that vaccine makers should be permitted to sue political candidates who bring up the matter, would you expand upon this and address the larger picture that is underway right now?
Yes. Well, I thought it was I thought it was important to respond, Gary, because I think it's rather extraordinary when we see law professors and medical professors urging censorship. That's novel. I mean, the U.S. does have an unusual tradition of free speech. It's more liberal in its approach to speech than really almost all other countries in the world. And to see a law professor and a medical professor advocating repression of speech, I found so extraordinary. I thought it really important to respond. As you point out, the article that they published on the website Jurist does not disclose that they have financial conflicts of interest. They both have received funding directly from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, which is the major federal spokesperson for and creator of the childhood vaccine program. And it's very harsh language. It's very, very harsh language in their article talking about the politicians having a free pass to spread public health lies and that people who claim there's a link between vaccines and autism are, you know, talking, they're yelling gunfire in a crowded theater. So I thought it was important to point out that the First Amendment does nothing to support their claim, that there's very good science and law and case law that supports the connection between vaccines and autism. And defamation is unavailable to these corporations because the corporations themselves acknowledge that there is a connection between vaccines, that there's at least a reported connection between vaccines and autism. So I thought it important, and I was very happy to see that the blog Jurist was willing to run a response. But it's disappointing to me that they ran their piece in the first place with no counter-arguments given at all.
That is not unusual. As I'm sure you're aware, every time we, meaning scientists or journalists, those who have researched the subject of safety and efficacy of vaccines, have offered an opportunity to present under oath before committees, state or federal, we have been, in effect, rejected. What you hear the predominance of are pro-vaccines, and that's where the policy is made. And then if they're forced to allow the parents of injured children come forth and make a statement, it's only peripheral, and it's not to the heart of it. Where do you see the contradictions lie between constitutional free speech and addressing the scientific and legal evidence that supports vaccines' risks and dangers? And are we not witnessing at some level an actual conspiracy to shut down public debate, which is in the past always has been one of the hallmarks of science when various hypotheses clash?
Yeah, I mean, science can't progress without speech, right? I mean, the whole notion of science is transparency and checking other people's data and verifying it. So their claim, Gary, is that this has already been established, and that's the CDC's claims. You know, it's asked and answered. We look at this question, it's decided, now let's move on, and because you all are so obstinate, let's just, you know, restrict your speech. I mean, it's antithetical to science, but it's certainly antithetical to our political protections and our political freedoms. However, that said, a prior health secretary in the United States, Sebelius, did request that the media not cover critics of vaccines when we had the H1N1, you know, scare. We know in the hearings that you referenced that there is very strong bias towards a pro-vaccine approach. And again, as you say, many of the people who are critical of vaccines, myself included, are not anti-vaccine. We simply think there are very important safety and efficacy issues that need to be robustly discussed. And part of my article is to say, how can we ever... Autism is a crisis. The CDC is now saying it's 1 in 45 children. 1 in 45 children, that's every classroom in America virtually. We can't really continue as a country if this rate keeps going up. In recent memory, it was 1 in 500. You know, if it just keeps going to 1 in 3, where will we be? These are very, very difficult, challenging medical issues to deal with. So we need a robust discussion now of this problem, and it's very disappointing to see leaders in the community calling for repression. I mean, and censorship almost inevitably leads to repression, right? I mean, it's repressive of speech, but it typically will go further than that. Censorship is not associated with, you know, developed democracies and prosperity. It's associated with repressive governments and economic lack of prosperity.
Absolutely well said. Right now, Representative Posey possesses all of the documents released by Dr. William Thompson at the CDC. Now, there are tens of thousands of pages, yet he is being stonewalled from getting the subcommittee to proceed with a formal hearing. Even Dr. Thompson has offered himself to be subpoenaed to appear in if such a hearing occurs. Now, given that Congress is not moving on the evidence of the CDC corruption and cover-ups of the vaccine autism connection, especially among African-American children, and you just mentioned it's 1 in 45, what message should this be sending to the public when Congress is actively suppressing the information that would show the connection?
Gary, it's mind-boggling. I've been working for years to try to get hearings on this. I delivered a briefing 2 years ago in Congress, and shortly, and we had at that point had a scheduled hearing, and then the briefing led to their deciding not to hold the hearing. It's appalling that people are unwilling to look at a problem straight up. It's really appalling. These people are not serving the public's interest. They are serving governmental interests and corporate interests, and it's extremely disappointing. But as you know, Representative Posey has given all of access to all of those documents that Dr. Thompson gave to him. He's now given them to a truly independent journalist, Ben Swan, who covered a rally at the CDC in Atlanta in November about Thompson. And I'm hopeful that early in the new year, journalist Swan will be coming out with these documents, at least some of them, and making them fully accessible. And we will have a window in then. We, in the community who care about this issue, we will have a window into what Thompson and his cohorts were doing at the CDC. And my strong sense is that we will be that we will be appalled by the kind of conversations that went on to cover up and to manipulate data and to destroy data. But I hope that it will be so galvanizing, Gary, that in the new year, there will be new, more widespread demands to get to the truth on this. And the demands for more mandatory vaccines, as in California, that you appropriately point out, that those will be, they will fall on deaf ears. People with this level of scandal and this level of fraud and misrepresentation and repression, I think we'll find it difficult to push through that kind of legislation, and I hope we'll have, at some point, a truly thoroughgoing review of what does the data show. This is a real scientific issue, and it affects, you know, not only all the children in the United States, but it's a global issue. The vaccine programs are similar around the world. The CDC has enormous influence on the World Health Organization, so this is a problem that's global. And we should be looking at it, you know, objectively and not trying to protect corporate interests or government interests.
I would agree with that. I will end with just this thought. Normally, you cannot sue the U.S. government without its permission or employees working for it. However, if it is found that there was a conspiracy of individuals to, with malice aforethought, to hide data that they didn't want the public to know about, and they were influenced by outside interests like pharmaceutical interest, that may represent an opportunity of bringing in some class action lawsuits. And I feel at some level, those individuals personally responsible for cover-up and hiding information, if that's proven by these documents, would be very fearful of destroying their reputations and destroying the entire edifice of the vaccine as a public health measure in the United States. So let's see what happens. It's going to happen quickly. I'm out here on the road now filming it. So I have my fourth film on vaccines due shortly, and we will have information that has never been seen before by journalists or politicians or anyone else in the news media that we have uncovered. So it's happening, and it's going to happen in the next year.
Terrific.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Professor Mary Holland, and director of the Graduate Legal Skills Program at New York University School of Law, and the website vaccineepidemic.com. The book is Vaccine Epidemic. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.
Send a telegram, send a telegram, whoa, send a telegram.